This is Scott Reeder, a founder of Suspect Convictions. This month, the trial of Stanley Liggins begins. In 1990, 9-year-old Jennifer Lewis was kidnapped, raped, strangled, and then dumped in a school playground and set on fire. I was one of the first people on the scene that night. What I saw will stay with me forever. And what I asked myself that night still resonates. Who would do such a thing? For 28 years, police have said Stanley Liggins, an ex-con who knew the family, committed the crime. But much of the evidence used against him has fallen into question. Last year, along with Lacey Scarmana of NPR affiliate WVIK, we launched this podcast to examine the case. We uncovered startling new information and experienced great success, rising to number 2 in the world on iTunes overall chart and capturing a top investigative reporting award from the Associated Press. Stanley Liggins has been granted a new trial, which begins later this month. I will be there covering the trial and providing you with daily episodes until a verdict is reached. Because many of you have joined the podcast since our first season, this week we will replay episode 1 to familiarize or refamiliarize everyone with the case. Next week, we will present a montage of the first season with perspectives from Lacey Scarmana and myself. And then the trial begins.
More than 26 years ago, Davenport, Iowa was the scene of a murder that left the community fearing for the safety of its children. The burning body of a 9-year-old girl was found in the playground of Jefferson Elementary School about 9 p.m. September 17, 1990. Scott Reeder was the night police reporter for the Quad City Times and one of the first people to come across the body. Today, Scott is writing a book about the case and, together with WVIK, is producing this podcast, Examining the Crime. I'm Lacey Scarmana, and you're listening to Suspect Convictions.
The streetlights come on, it's getting dark. She's supposed to be home before the streetlights come on. She wasn't home yet, so I'm thinking she's just out there playing with a friend. She never came home.
She should be playing with a friend. She should be going to school and enjoying herself. You know, not strangled, murdered, and treated like a piece of garbage.
Seeing her laying there smoldering is tore up. It's one of those cases that never leave you. Stanley's making sure of that.
There's no doubt whatsoever in my mind or heart that they have the right man.
He looked at and or processed 10,000 items of evidence and never found anything that connected Jennifer and Stanley.
I mean, I like cheese, but I'm not a rat. I like kids, but not like that.
You are listening to Suspect Convictions, a podcast from WVIK examining the murder of 9-year-old Jennifer Ann Lewis and the case against the man accused of killing her. Stanley Liggins has been tried and convicted twice for the murder. Both convictions were overturned. Jennifer was murdered in 1990. That's 2 years before I was even born. And the case against Stanley is still going on. In this podcast, we'll explain why. Over the past year or so, as Scott Reeder has been doing research for his book, he's recorded more than 60 interviews with people close to the case. You'll hear from several of those people in this first episode. So let's start at the beginning, with Scott sharing what he remembers from the night of September 17th, 1990.
I remember quite a bit, actually. It's one of the worst days of my life. And it's one of those days you don't expect. I was the night cop reporter for the Quad City Times. I was in my early 20s. Back in those days, we carried two radios with us. One was a portable police scanner that we could hear what was going on with the different squad cars in the community. And the other one was a radio that went back to the city editor of the paper. And I heard across this police scanner there was a fire at Jefferson Elementary School. And my reaction at the time was, well, that's probably not even worth checking out. I mean, it was a neighborhood that was a little rough around the edges at that time, and it wasn't uncommon for people just to burn trash in the vacant lot around there. So I didn't really think much of it. Then this
voice of my editor back in the newsroom came on and says, there's a fire at a school, Scott, check it out. And I kind of rolled my eyes and I thought, oh, I'll check it out. Now, this is the way I recall it. I know I was one of the very first people on the scene, but I know for certain that when I got there, that I didn't know what I was coming across. I pulled up, and I believe there was a police officer there that had got arrived about the same time I had. And we walked over to where some taller grass on the edge of the school playground. And we could see, where we could see smoke rising from the grass. And instead of seeing a trash fire, I saw a child who had been doused with gasoline and set on fire. Child was obviously dead. She had a hand stuck up in the air, kind of into a claw-like grip. It was just the most horrifying thing I've ever seen in my life. I kind of staggered back. I was sick to my stomach. I did not anticipate that at all. And so I got on my radio and I radioed back to the newsroom. There's a body here. The editor quickly radioed back to me. Well, what? Tell me about it. And I said, well, I think it's a child. And he says, is it a boy or a girl? And I said, I just can't tell because she'd been covered with gasoline. She was on fire as I was speaking to him. I could see the smoke rising up from the body. There was melted plastic bags on her. And for me just to look at this child, it was just one of the most horrific things I've ever seen in my life. And then I watched as vehicles started to arrive. We saw my friend Dave Holden. He was a sergeant in charge of the night shift detectives for Davenport. And I saw his boss, Don Schaefer. He was the lieutenant in charge of the day-to-day operations of the Detective Bureau. And I saw Ted Carroll, who was this wizened old captain. Dave Holden since has died. Don Schaefer, who later became police chief, isn't talking right now. And Ted Carroll, too, has died. That's been an issue throughout this case because many of the people who investigated or were at the scene have since died. I saw Kevin Murphy there. He was a detective.
I got a phone call from Schaefer about right around 9:30, 10 o'clock area, and called me into work. So I did, but seeing her laying there smoldering when I got there, you know, it just tore you up, you know. And it's one of those cases that never leave you.
And then we saw the fire truck arrive.
I had never seen a body burned like that before.
That's Dave Perrick. He's now 54 and a captain with the Davenport Fire Department. But back in 1990, he was a 27-year-old junior private working the back end of a fire truck.
It was terrible. Once we pulled up, you know, the realization came all of a sudden. You know, we just pulled up and, you know, everything's a routine little fire that you gotta kick out, and there wasn't a whole lot of fire there by the time we pulled up. And then
I just remember smoldering. I don't remember.
And it just took a little sweep from the pressurized water, the 3-gallon, and she was out. And immediately we just backed up. It was immediately apparent that we had a crime scene.
What do you remember thinking when you saw that? Was that what? I
mean, oh my gosh! Yeah, it was. It was. It just, oh my God, that's about all I can say. It's something you just don't expect. And all of a sudden, there it is.
It was a very somber, very surreal time. We were standing there, and then the reporters started arriving. This was about 9 o'clock at night when the body was discovered. And all of a sudden, channels 4, 6, and 8 arriving with their reporters and their cameramen. They're setting up their tripods only a few feet away from the body. And they start doing live shots. It was the most graphic images I can imagine going on live television. One of the reporters was Lisa Toronto. She was a reporter for Channel 4 TV, WHBF.
It's just one of those memories that are etched in your mind forever, and it's horrific, and, you know, it just brings back that feeling of just helplessness for this poor child who would do something like that. And I think it, being 22 and seeing something like that for the first time in my years of reporting, you know, you're just not ready for something like that. You aren't ready for it. And it takes you aback, and that's your first awakening to how can people be so horrible. And I'll never forget that.
We could see what was happening clearer now because their Klieg lights were on and this dark lot. Then Paul Beckman, who was the Scott County medical examiner at the time, arrived. He walked up and he was examining the body, and then he walks over to me and I said to him, "What do you see?" And Paul says, "I think it's a 12-year-old girl." He said, "It is a child, that she's been badly burned." That's about all I can tell you, Scott. I mean, so I step back and remember walking across the grass and trying to see what else I could find out. It was an open field behind the playground. It was obviously a lot of trash had been strewn across the field. I could see Denny Kern, who was the head of the ID section at the Davenport Police Department. He was doing everything he could to preserve the crime scene.
You could still smell the gas. That was just the whole thing was, okay, let's see what we've got. We get her out of here. What else do we have? Did we have any tire tracks or anything like that? And there wasn't any. There was nothing definable. We knew we were going to have to, you know, secure the neighborhood for the night so we could search it in the morning, because no matter how good the lighting is at night, it's never anything compared to sunlight.
He wanted to make sure that, you know, if the killer had left behind a cigarette butt, or if the killer had handled a bottle that was on the scene, that, you know, the fingerprints or the evidence that would be left behind would be preserved. You know, at this time, I'm just radioing back little tidbits back to the newsroom, and somebody else is writing the story and just compiling it back together. The newscasts are over, so the reporters are kind of milling around like, well, the newscast's over, what should we do? At this point, it's getting pretty late, and I know that the Quad City Times has gone to bed, which means they've gone to press, and this was in the days before the internet. There was no way we could update the story after the paper had gone to press. And as we're standing there waiting to see if any more information's forthcoming, a rumor started spreading among the reporters and among some of the other people working the scene that a child was missing in Rock Island. For those of you who are listening in from outside of this region, the Quad Cities is a metropolitan area of a couple hundred thousand people. It's four cities, obviously, Bettendorf and Davenport, Iowa, and Rock Island and Moline, Illinois. They hug the Mississippi River. While they're two different states, they're very much one community. The home of where this girl who was missing was only 3 miles away from the playground in Davenport. So even though they were in different states, they were very close to one another. So the rumor started spreading that there was a child missing. And of course, the question everybody had to ask was, is this the missing child?
Across the river, Sherry Glenn was looking for her daughter, Jennifer.
Jennifer's playing across at Samuel's. She come home excited, almost running her bike into the porch. She come in and said Stanley said she could keep the change. She went and got him a pack of gum. I got up and went to go into Jennifer's bedroom to breastfeed. Half an hour, 45 minutes later, I come out, everybody was gone. I asked where Stanley went. And Joe said he was still on the front porch. He wasn't. Next thing you know, Jennifer didn't come home.
Sherry called 911 and reported Jennifer missing. She asked some kids who Jennifer had played with if they had seen her. They said they hadn't. Jennifer's stepfather, Joe, rode around on her bicycle looking for her. And back at the house, a neighbor came over to share what he had seen on the news.
Brett Titus come running down to the house saying they found a 12-year-old little girl for a body in Davenport. They said a 12-year-old blonde-haired little girl. Wife said it's not her because she don't have blonde hair. She got brown and she's only going to be 10. It's not her. And I wouldn't believe him if it was her.
Meanwhile, the body found at the elementary school had been taken to a local hospital. Denny Kern with the Davenport police collected fingerprints from the body.
We had to get her fingerprints, and we got fingerprints off of one hand and the other one was consumed.
Another officer went to the elementary school Jennifer attended so they could compare fingerprints from her textbooks. The prints matched.
She should be playing with her friends. She should be playing games. She should be going to school and enjoying herself. You know, not strangled, you know, murdered and treated like a piece of garbage and then dumped out, only to be burned afterward. Kid homicides have always bothered me. Simply because of that, they're innocent. They should be enjoying life and not have to be going through something that's horrific. It was a lousy way to die. You know, she had to be terrified. That's the part that's always bothered me, is that they just have no way out. There's nothing you can do for them. You can't undo it. You can't make it better. You can't go back in time.
The next day, police took Sherry to the funeral home to see her daughter.
I seen her laying in there, and her hair was all matted against her face, and I could see her teeth sticking out. And I wanted to go in there and hug her and hold her, and they told me no, I couldn't. Of course, I didn't want to leave the funeral home. I remember grabbing a hold of the pole down there.
I remember waking up the next morning from being at that crime scene, and I've never experienced a community in that much fear before. That morning, talking to my neighbors in Davenport, they were really afraid, and there were parents that were terrified to allow their children out of their sight. And the Davenport police were under enormous pressure to solve this case. Scott County Attorney Bill Davis was also under a lot of pressure to charge someone in the crime.
Well, you have an innocent child who is a victim of a heinous crime, a defenseless citizen. Yeah, that just sets everybody on edge.
Stanley Liggins spent a lot of time around Jennifer's family. Sherry testified in court that she met Stanley when her husband was in jail and she needed money to bail him out. So she began selling cocaine for Stanley. This continued after Joe was released, and Stanley remained a fairly frequent visitor at their home. Police arrested Stanley within days of the murder. A witness allegedly saw him outside the liquor store where Jennifer went to buy gum. That was the last place she was seen alive. Another witness came to police with a description of taillights she allegedly saw near the fire at the elementary school that night. One taillight was much brighter than the other, and that description matched the lights on Stanley's Peugeot. Stanley also failed a polygraph test. So the evidence seemed to be stacking up against him. But a lot of new information has come out since then. For example, one of the witnesses, the one who saw the taillights, had a history as a paid police informant for one of the senior officers in the detective bureau. Mike Toby, Stanley's defense attorney in the second trial, doesn't trust her testimony.
My gut just tells me that she got juiced up. I think she had some speck of some kind of knowledge. And I have never been able to find out what or how. And she was juiced up.
By who?
And, well, I would assume it had to be by investigators. I don't think there were people, you know, working the streets trying to find informants, you know, civilians. So you know, the only other place you could look would be those who were in control of the investigation.
And there wasn't much physical evidence to rely on, as Gary McHenrick, Stanley's first defense attorney, tried to emphasize in court.
I was cross-examining one of the criminalists from the crime lab on it, and I asked him, you know, how many pieces of evidence they had examined, and it was in the thousands. And I asked him then, was there any fiber or hair evidence from Jennifer in Stanley's car in his apartment? No. Was there any fiber or hair evidence from Stanley or Stanley's apartment and car at the location of the body? No.
Plus, the defense claims the prosecution withheld evidence. 78 police reports, some of which they say potentially point to another suspect being involved in the crime. In another episode, we'll take a look at the evidence pointing toward and away from Stanley. We'll talk about how his race is a factor that looms over his case. Here's Mike Toby.
You have a little Caucasian girl who comes from sad circumstances, certainly would naturally garner sympathy, even post-mortem, from almost anyone. And you had a black man accused of sexual acts as well as her death.
This murder happened more than two decades ago, but it will be in the news again soon as Stanley goes to trial for the third time. But Scott's been following this case all along. He talks about why he went so in-depth with this particular story.
One of the things is we found that the child that died was from a very poor family and had gone through some difficult times in her very short life. And, you know, I think about, as I've been a reporter for a long time and later an editor, that there's a tendency in the media to treat certain lives differently than other lives. You think about Elizabeth Smart, the girl in Utah who disappeared. You think about JonBenet Ramsey, the girl in Colorado who was murdered. You think about a lot of these cases that stick out in your mind, and what makes them unusual or what makes them newsworthy, these were children from wealthy families. And this little girl was not. She'd grown up in very tragic circumstances, and I think her life counts. I think it matters. I think it's important that this case be looked at carefully. We have this horrible crime. We have a man who's being put on trial 26 years after the fact, and yet there's evidence or facts that would seem to point away from him. There's also some evidence that points towards him. But, you know, one of the things that seems to get lost in this story, in stories like this, is who was the victim? What was she like? What did she experience in her life?
Next week, more on Jennifer Lewis. She loved her bike, her pet rock, and her baby brother. Memories of Jennifer from her family and friends.
Jennifer was the cutest little girl tomboy. Yeah. She'd go out looking like a little princess and come home looking like a little boy.
And some of the tough circumstances she grew up in.
And I had no evidence of sexual abuse. I just had evidence of neglect.
That's next time on Suspect Convictions. Production assistance comes from Alfredo Montega. Thanks to WVIK CEO Jay Pierce and WVIK staff Jared Johnson, Michelle O'Neill, Herb Trix, and Dave Garner. All archived audio was generously provided by WQAD TV Channel 8 in the Quad Cities.
That's horrible.
That's true.
So strange.
Usually.
I can't imagine what that's like.
Do you want to?
That could never happen to me.
It might.
Lock him away. He's pure evil. Or insane.
Or human. My name's Kate. I have worked as a forensic psychologist, as well as in prisons and as a crisis clinician. My job was to figure out who gets locked up and who gets a key, to find the humanity in inhumane situations. So, are you sure you really want to know?
Yeah, maybe.
Because by the end of the episodes, you just might end up thinking...
I felt better before I knew that.
You can find me at IWB Podcast on Facebook, Twitter, sometimes Instagram, or you can email me at IWBpodcast@gmail.com.